This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Diti Menendez is here today. She is, I believe, the foremost curator of art and poetry in America. But today, she's our poet. And here's an opening poem from Diti Dolce Menendez.
Green. The road we take leads to our demise. Look at this road I travel every Sunday. I pass rows and rows of tall green corn alongside the purple majesty flowers. It is such a different road and so far away from the road we thought we were following that morning we left Havana. My mother is waiting in the distant hallway, small in stature compared to the woman who used to take me by the hand whenever we had to cross roads. Every Sunday, I ask her the same question. Mami, ¿tú sabes quién soy yo? She doesn't answer, so I ask her again as if she did not hear me the first time or the second time or the third time. Once I feel my eyes starting to swell, I stop. My mother's eyes are green pools of oceans, swam now replaced by the rows of rows and rows of green cornfields without the sting of salt in the air. Yet it's the same clear blue sky blanket that covered us when we left for liberty. My mother's eyes in silence tell me who I am every Sunday. We are still refugees. She to Alzheimer's and me to continually asking myself who I am.
You know, Diti, the thing I have loved and I love more than anything this morning is the truth in your poetry. There is no artifice. There are no showboating tricks. There's no adornment. It is the clear, piercing truth that makes your poetry so stunning, really. And what you feel, we feel. Now, that is a poem I never heard before. Is it a new poem?
No, I wrote this when she was still in the home and at the beginning of her being in the home. So she was in the home about 2 years when I wrote this, and she just passed away this last April.
I remember. I have a great bond with her because we were born in the same year and the same month. I've always felt a huge bond with her, and when she passed away as well. But she was the strength in your life, and she must have been a hell of a woman because you are bold. You are unafraid. Is that what you got from her?
No, she actually wasn't that strong. She overcame a lot of pain in her life. She was left an orphan when she was 5, and she was placed in home after home.
Imagine.
With different family members. And so she went through a lot of pain, and then she met my father, and she thought, finally, you know, peace and love. And then my father had a mental breakdown 3 months into the wedding. And then we left Cuba, and then here we are. She's gone. My father's gone. I'm here in the middle of the Midwest with only a sister who remembers that time to share with me.
Yes, she has the missing piece of the puzzle, Yvonne.
Right.
And she's a huge artist. I have to tell everyone that you are a poet and an artist, and that you revolutionized the internet. That during the 2020s, all during the 2020s, you were predominant in producing poetry. I think the first online magazine was the one that you had that I was familiar with. You changed my life. Diti, how much time do you spend on your own poetry? What percentage of your life do you spend on your own poetry?
Very little.
And how many hours would you say you spend looking at art and poetry from the other people? 80% of your time or 90?
Well, let's put it this way. I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning so that I can talk to artists who live in either Europe or Australia. And I go to bed, you know, so I get my 6 or 7 hours of sleep, but I'm up very early at the crack of dawn, before the crack of dawn to work with my community.
that you have taken figurative art to a whole new level. Why is it that you've chosen figurative art that, rather than, say, expressionism or watercolors, you have really moved that to the top of the curve in America?
Well, those are all nice things you say, but I'm not responsible for many of those things. There were other people doing that as well. I just happened to stumble upon realism and figurative art. The whole reason why I started publishing art was because I wanted readers to read the poems. It wasn't because I wanted to show them art. I wanted readers to pick up the magazine, and because it had art, but because I wanted them to read the poems, and then the poems sort of took a backstage and the art just took over.
Well, then that I have to tell everybody that you are the curator at 33 Contemporary in Chicago, that you have curated art shows in New York, Barcelona, Australia, Florida, many places again in New York and Chicago, and that this small hobby you have has really changed American distribution. So at what moment do you say to yourself, I can do this, I want to do this, I'm going to do this? What moment do you remember that you just took hold of this?
You mean as far as writing poetry or?
Well, let's start as a poet.
When I went online back in the 1990s, I stumbled across poetry boards for some reason. Back then they were on Yahoo. And I started to communicate with poets for some reason. I don't know how I ended up, you know, in that route. I never thought of myself as a writer of poetry, but I ended up talking to them, and I wanted to create a magazine. And I didn't have the resources to create a real magazine. I only had the internet. So I learned how to create a website. And I taught myself HTML and coding and anything I needed to do to get a magazine online. And I happened to be around poets, so I published poetry. And then we started winning contests. And I said, okay, well, maybe I have a hand here for something. And, you know, the poets started getting attention and started being recognized in different anthologies. And so here I am with you now.
And you have actually taken many poets who are really celebrated today from A to the zenith. Now, let us go back to your own poetry. At what time did you just start writing poetry?
I started writing poetry in the late 90s when I was surrounded by these other poets. I don't like doing something unless I can do it myself. Whether I do it good or not, that's another question. But I like being able to know what I'm talking about. And the only way to know what I'm talking about is if I do it myself.
Well, let's hear a poem.
Okay, let's hear The First Time Ever I Saw a Hummingbird.
Love that one.
The hummingbird poem is not about messages, it's about memory. Not only my memory is what I included in that poem, I included the memory also of the women that I used to talk to during our time in the hotel in Miami Beach. They tell me stories about their life in Germany and the pain that they went through and everything that happened because they were Jewish. And the hummingbird basically just represents a trigger in a memory. And the poem is about my memory, but also their memory. And that's why it ends the way it does. And I felt a connection to them, even back then. Even though I'm not Jewish, I'm Catholic, I'm Cuban, they were German, but they lost something during a war. They lost their family, they lost their livelihoods, they lost more than any other war, recent war. I mean, anyway, the poem is about loss. It's not about messages. And I felt a connection to them because my family, even though they didn't go through the same situation that they went through with being Jewish and in Germany, my family lost a lot also when they left Cuba. So I felt a connection with them. And that's what the poem is about. It's not about messages or something frivolous. It's about a connection to humanity, to finding a resemblance in something that happened a long time ago.
That is poetry of compassion. So let us hear this.
The first time ever I saw a hummingbird. The first time ever I saw a hummingbird, the Santa Ana winds were thrusting somewhere through Sunset Boulevard and Highland Avenue, and the school bell for Hollywood High rang for first period as the humming sound and the bell ringing and the children rustling left me in a tailspin round and round while a song from long ago twirled around my tongue like a horse with no name. I paused and leaned in to make sure of what I was seeing, for I had never before had a hummingbird present itself to me as if it were a revelation of what was to come or what had already expired. As a filler paper flew out of my denim three-ring notebook and the little bird kept flapping its wings and the beak was like that of a stingray, which once passed by my legs as I jumped for safety in the shallow ocean in Miami, where we would vacation when I was 10, and little old Jewish women from New York had come to retire, and I would sit with them in the foyer of the crumbling Art Deco Hotel facing Ocean Drive, and they'd tell me stories about their life in Germany, like that one time they encountered a Nazi for the first time. And after we play cards, while the air conditioner's white noise broke through our age difference, as the sun had burnt the skin off my nose crisp. And then 5 years later, I would encounter a hummingbird for the very first time, ever humming and humming and humming, the beak pointing and poking, going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth like a bayonet, stabbing at lifeless bodies among the ruins.
That is a fabulous poem, one of your best. The reason I like that poem is because I felt that hummingbird was a messenger. I always felt it was like an angel that came to you and said, you are not like everyone else. I like very much the way you insert, you're sitting with the old women and listening to their stories about Nazi Germany, because I always teach my students to come in and insert a little knot in the middle of the ribbon so it fans in and fans out. That is why I love that poem so much. And so let's hear another.
Okay. The elephant in the room. It starts with the bagpipes. The distant sound of horses' hooves, the wind shuffling through the birches, young men running naked through the thorny bushes, a girl drawing John Lennon on a cardboard, her mother weaving threads through a Singer sewing machine, stopping to oil the crank, the squeaky bottle spilling a drop onto a garment, a cough. The gray sorrowful faces from the television, memorizing the lyrics to a Beatles song, Rocky Raccoon, Gidgen's Bible. Her father's razor, rusty. Phlegm coughed up and spit to the walls. Her father heavy, pacing the halls. Her mother mopping the floors. The woodwinds trailing, the bagpipes whirling, the boy next door sitting under a mango tree. An old man raking the leaves. A dog whimpering, a train whistle abandoning, the sad faces in the television witnessing, the hum of the air conditioner, your sister shivering, Your father's soiled underwear in the laundry basket.
The truth, nothing works but the truth. The way you list just gains momentum. The way you list line after line after line is like I call motion lotion. That thing moves like silk, Dee Dee.
That poem is about my growing my life in Miami when I was a child.
Was it hard to write?
No, it just comes to me. These poems, I don't spend a lot of time editing. I mean, I do have to go back and check for typos, which I'm notorious for, but they come to me and I write them down as they come to me. Sometimes they just take a few days to develop in my head before I write them down.
Well, I always ask everyone that, you know, I teach, and I always ask everyone to think about sound and visuals and images. And that poem has everything in it. It has the visual, it has the sound, it has all of the elements, and you don't even plan it. You don't even plan it that way. All you're doing is trying to record your life.
Well, that's true. That's basically how my life was when we lived in this duplex in Miami in Little Havana. Well, it wasn't Little Havana at the time, part of Little Havana. And my father would pace the hallways back and forth, and we lived near the train, so we would listen to the train whistle come through. Yeah. And the TV. We had black and white TV at the time. So,
and from that, you have devoted your life to beauty. So there must have been beauty in your life.
Well, there was beauty in my life because my mother was beautiful. So we always looked up to her. But we also had art in the house. She cared about art. And we always had something hanging, whether it was a Sacred Heart or whether it was the Last Supper or whether it was a textile that my father would bring from the pawn shop or from his visits to New York. We always had art around us. So that was an influence.
That had to be. And little did you know then, when you were in that duplex, that you would be traveling virtually among the most promising artists in this world.
Oh, exactly. I'm still to this day mesmerized by who I have met. I mean, I was emailing Robert Creeley 3 months before he died. Can you imagine?
I do.
3 months before he died, he and I were emailing each other, and I was asking him to edit an issue of Mi Poesias, and he said, Dee Dee, I'm too old for this.
It is true. You just plunged right into the world and just brought everybody up with you, right above. From under the water, you brought them right up to the surface. And you had the greatest poets in your magazine. Now, let's see. You had online publications. Then you had radio online, Meepo Radio.
Right.
You had print magazine, Ocho, Meepoesias. Then Poets and Artists, which I consider the best art magazine in America. And all this within 25 years?
Well, 20 years, 21 years. But Meepo Radio wasn't a radio, it was an actual, it was a podcast back in 2005 before anybody was doing podcasts.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, it was the first podcast. That's the point I would like to make in this program, that you were breaking ground online with art, with technology, and it actually began because of your expertise in technology. So that how did you turn that knowledge of all those little programs to create a world? I mean, you technically, you must be a genius.
Grace, you give me too much credit. I had to get help with the podcast. Bernie Jaworski helped me tremendously back in that time to set up the podcast because I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew I wanted to do it. And so then I communicated with the people I needed to get it done. And she helped me back then. So she was really the reason why I was able to have a podcast. And as far as publishing, I would basically just ask people if they'd like to be published. And many of them would say no, but then there would be some that would say yes. And the ones that said yes ended up getting, you know,
famous.
Well, they may have been already famous. They just added an extra dimension to their resume.
It is, what I hear coming through this is, I just wanted to do it. I just wanted to do it. So let's hear another poem. Dee Dee Menendez, who is actually my cultural hero and who has raised my spirits so high that I think she's prolonged my life. I really do believe that.
Thank you, Grace. You're too kind to me. I'm going to read one more poem. This one is about poets. It's called So Much. There's a poet taking a nap lying on a red wheelbarrow. Of course, the poet is an adult and too big to fit inside a red wheelbarrow. So the feet and arms are dangling outside the red wheelbarrow. But nonetheless, a red wheelbarrow is the best place for a poet to take a nap in the middle of a perfectly good afternoon. Place a face and a name to the poet. Let's say the poet is Bukowski, and he has a black pussycat curled up on his stomach, purring like a black pussycat should. Bukowski strokes the black pussycat's head and mumbles something about that time he was delivering the mail. And you want to hear the rest, but he is, after all, taking a nap, and the black cat is purring, and flies are circling something in the distance, and retching smell makes it to your nostril as the breeze circles the red wheelbarrow. And then Dickinson is in the red wheelbarrow, looking daintily straight at the sun because she is not afraid of pain. And her black heavy dress dangles over the red wheelbarrow, and the dust settles on the tips of her pointy black shoes. The black cat is now parakeet in a tiny bird cage she holds over her heart. The parakeet tweets and flutters in the tiny cage. Dickinson shushes the parakeet with a lullaby, which only makes the tweets louder and louder and louder as a cloud of cigarette smoke sails off into the distance, because now Sexton is in the red wheelbarrow. She is wearing the perfect little black dress, and her manicured nails circle around her pearls. Her long legs are crossed and hanging out the red wheelbarrow as she rubs them against each other because that feels good, and she has a poem stuck between her thighs that needs to be released. Once the poem is climaxed, she mutters, "What a piece of shit," and lights another cigarette and places a hand over her left breast as if she is about to say an anthem. But instead, she cups it hard because she likes it as you watch her. You then realize why William said that so much depends on a red wheelbarrow.
Did you know that you were a surrealist? What do you
think? Well, I'm something else, that's for sure.
Does that come from a dream, Dee Dee?
No.
Well, it's interesting because I don't think you consider yourself a surrealist, but you certainly put together the images like that. How do you describe that poem?
Well, that poem basically is just an analogy of, if you notice, I said black a lot throughout the poem. So it's basically just about depression.
But it is about more, because there are hints in there. For instance, when you say Emily Dickinson looks up at the sun because she is not afraid, was that one line?
Because she's afraid of pain.
She's not afraid of pain. And that is the, interesting enough, that is the transcendent line in that poem. That it's, you know, it's like where the poem turns. Mm-hmm. It's poetry is the wound. Poetry is the wound in us. But that when you have her looking up at the sun because she's not afraid of the pain, that's why we write the poem.
Yes, that's why we write the poem, to sort of like exorcism.
It transforms all that is ugly. It transforms it once you make it art and say it clearly. it transforms. I mean, what could be more holy than that?
Well, I a lot of the poems I've written have been therapeutic.
I think 100% of the poets would agree with that. Let's hear another poem and then we'll talk about the Moon Project. But I have to say, you've always put everyone first.
Well, but it's because of them that I was able to live my dream. It's because of them.
Let's hear a poem.
One more poem? Okay. I hope I don't stumble upon it again.
This is human radio, DD. It's human radio.
I don't read my own poems very well. That's why I ask other people to read them sometimes. Okay. This one's called Between Yoko Ono and a Hard Place. Between Yoko Ono and a Hard Place. There was a man. There always is a man. Let's say this man was a hippie in the 60s and grew a beard, a blonde beard, and hung out in Central Park with his guitar and his lyrics. Let's say he took too many drugs, drank too much bourbon, slept with too many women. Let's say it's today and you are in your garden and are clipping back the bushes and pulling out weeds, and this man comes to mind whom you met 20 years after he gave up New York and moved south. You met him after he lost his family because he drank too much bourbon and slept with too many women, who would creep into his thoughts as he was making love to his wife. And although he was faithful to his wife, she could feel Yoko Ono tearing them apart because she thought they were tight like the Beatles. You meet him at work and invite him over to your house, and he brings his guitar and tells you a story about that one time in New York his girlfriend was at a bar and John Lennon walks in and takes a seat with Yoko or that other woman he dated between Yoko. Let's say that our man stayed at home that evening because he had a cold or the flu or was having a nervous breakdown. Let's say his girlfriend decides not to call him from a phone booth just down by the corner to tell him to get his ass over to the bar because John Lennon was there. John Lennon was there. Let's say this was the catalyst of his life. The worst thing a woman could have done, worse than divorcing him, worse than dying on him like his mother did. Let's say that this man comes to mind where you are yanking out a tough root and out of the corner of a dark place you try never to visit, you remember this man died last year on John Lennon's birthday. Imagine that.
Oh, that last line is a killer. Right.
Well, that actually happened. This was a friend of mine who I met when he was living in Florida, and he was dating this girl who went to the bar and actually met John Lennon, and she didn't call him to tell him to go to the bar, knowing perfectly well that this man was like John, like his, you know.
His idol.
Idol, right. He was his idol, and the girlfriend didn't care enough about him to call him. So obviously she wasn't in love with him. She didn't care about him. Never forgave her.
But what is there about that story that gets you?
Well, that I remembered it on John Lennon's birthday, October 9th.
Uh-huh. What is
music? That's what triggered the poem.
What does music mean to you, DD? Because you used to use a lot of music with Mi Poesias online.
Well, I was also a Beatles fan. They were a big impact to a little girl, you know, watching TV, the Ed Sullivan Show. So my parents on Sundays, we'd watch TV, the Ed Sullivan Show, and music, and the Supremes would come on, and we were just, I could see the way that my parents would see them perform, and how happy they were just watching TV and the Ed Sullivan Show. And somehow that impacted my life. We also lived with an uncle of mine who was a teenager in the 60s. So we all lived together. It was my grandmother, my uncle, Gallo, who's only 12 years older than me. And he was a teenager at the time when we came from Cuba, and he would bring his girlfriends and listen to music and radio and his albums. And that was a big American impact on me. So yeah, that's basically what it was. Music is what connected me to being an American.
Very interesting. I have a poem about eating cottage cheese in a restaurant. I had never seen it before because at home we just had ricotta. And my line is, at last, I'm an American. I know exactly what you mean. But Dee Dee, there's something about that moment when you saw the glitter and the beauty of celebrity and what it was to have a light shining on people that I believe turned you into that person who wanted to make it happen.
Well, the thing is that television was a very, very big impact. I mean, I not only saw the Beatles on the television, I also witnessed, I was young enough, I was only 3 at the time, but I witnessed John F. Kennedy dying on the TV. And later in the 60s, when we'd sit there, we'd watch Vietnam just streaming through television all of a sudden, and then John F. Kennedy's dead, Vietnam. Then you have Martin Luther King being shot. Then you have Robert F. Kennedy being shot. Then you've got all these horrible things happening in front of my eyes the first decade of my life.
But Dee Dee, the visuals are still in your body. What I'm saying is that I see a girl impacted by a visual, by sensual sensibilities that you took into your body and you give out into the world.
Well, that yes, that is what basically is my catalyst is TV. You know, media is what caused all these emotions, you know, to eventually come out.
That's exactly right. And somewhere along the line, you said, I can not only be a viewer, I can actually do it. I can actually create this material. I don't have to just look at the content. I can make the content. And that is what you have done. So tell us, my daughters said to me the other day, you know, Dee Dee's the ultimate. And they said that because from the beginning, all you did with my own poetry and other people's, but all of a sudden now you have got our poetry on the moon.
Right.
Dee is the ultimate. Tell us about the Peregrine Project.
Well, basically, I was discussing this with Dr. Samuel Peralta, who is the one who is putting together the payload to send to the moon. I have been communicating with him for, I don't know, a decade or so. And I would always send him my PDFs for him to review. You know, I just sent him the PDFs and he kept them. And then when he was getting ready to do the payload, he wanted to bring joy to more people and artists and writers, he basically used what was on his desktop that I had sent him all these years. And that's how you guys all ended up in the moon, because I used to send him free PDFs and he just grabbed what he had available and put it on a little disc to send to the moon. So
he digitized it.
Well, basically, they were all PDFs.
Oh, they were digitized. And so what are they in? What's a time capsule?
So then it's a little clip of a file that it's not the actual print that's going up. We're not going to be littering the moon. These are...
It's like a thumb drive.
Yeah, like a little square
chip
file that has all this art and poetry and writings that he had available, and he put them on that disc, and it was just serendipity that whoever happened to be in the magazine that was on his desktop or his computer files ended up going to the moon. And many of my publications, which I've been publishing through the last decade or so, ended up being part of it.
Has it already gone?
No, in July is when the launch will take place. which is good because that's when the man first landed on the moon in 1969 in July, and this payload is going up in July. So that's great.
Where will it land on the lunar?
If you go to the peregrine.com website, peregrinecollection.com website, or Google it, there's information about it on the website and how it works. So that's what I would recommend everybody to just go to to Dr. Peralta's website to learn more about it.
Dee Dee, when you were a little girl watching TV in Miami, did you really think that you'd be an agent to get women on the moon for the first time?
No. I mean, my grandmother let us stay up on July 20th, 1969, late to watch on her brand new color television, the man landing on the moon. Of course, it was in black and white because even though the television was in color, the film was still in black and white. But I witnessed that. And it made a big impact on me. And what I never thought that something I would do would end up in the moon. But even back then in 1969, there was art already placed on the moon back in 1969.
Oh.
And it was mostly the abstract expressionist, about six artists. And one of them was Andy Warhol, another one Robert, I forget his last name right now. Anyway, about six abstract expressionists, including Andy Warhol, is already up in the moon. And now with my publication, the insight of Dr. Peralta, adding them to this file, we're placing women and a very diverse group of artists that have been totally ignored for centuries. And they're going to be on the moon, including poets.
You know what, Dee Dee?
Including you, Grace. You're one of the poets that's going to the moon.
You know what? You have sent me to the moon many, many times, Dee Dee. Let me say this. Can you believe that there is something about your life that you're not in charge of? It seems like there's so much hydraulic under your, so much under your wings that you have just moved along, but somehow can't explain.
Well, I would say yes and yes, possibly, but that means that it's also brought a lot of pain.
Is that necessary?
Well, the pain that my family's gone through and that my father's turmoil caused. So I don't believe necessarily in fate. I believe more that we are all here and we all have a plan, and depending on or not if you act upon it, it will happen.
And I must add that hard work is what gets it over the finish line. And you are a person who works like 14 hours a day, and I know that for a fact. So let us have a closing poem.
Okay, I'm going to read. It's not about it's about my daughter, but it's not necessarily the one you asked for. It's a different one. It's called Tuesday. Tuesday. The dog died on a Tuesday. Do not embark on a Tuesday. Do not get married on a Tuesday. Friday the 13th envies Tuesday. Wars start on Tuesday. The lizard catcher does not believe in Tuesdays. To her, it is a day after Monday. She is in her room drawing a monster eating a daffodil. Goya approves. There are sonnets already being written about her. She will not let me read them. She has one written by every boy and girl who has fallen for her rolling eyes and her witty LOL messages. She practically has had one written about her for almost every day of the week, except for Tuesdays.
The voice of Dee Dee Menendez. This program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipet Fund. with additional support from Avidesha Shani and Diane Wilbon Parks. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.